Mr. Martin, reel 11. We'd come to the point, I think, after the rest period, where you started moving northeast of Rome into the Monte Rotondo area. Now, could you give us an idea of some... I know you ran into a fair amount of trouble there, so tell us the story of that.
Yes. We had the Monte Rotondo, and the ground was rather nice from a tank point of view, in that it was undulating, with a fair amount of space to spread out, which was a bit unusual because we'd been tied to roads for some time. And we were ordered to move north to this area. And I think I'm right in saying that we came across a sort of factory at which the Germans were evacuating. We were ordered to form up on the ridge, and the battle took place there.
What do you remember of that?
Well, I was ordered to join the squadron there. They seemed to have gone by a different route. I was reserve trooper. We moved up onto the bridge, and when I looked over at all the others, there was this factory in the distance, and the Germans seemed to have been caught on the hop, and they were moving out. We had a shelling to do with them. We flattened the place more or less. We got a number of trucks. But there was a lot of smoke, of course, from the firing of the squadron of tanks lined up. And we ran short of ammunition, so we were ordered to go back where we replenished stocks, which were brought up by the honey tank, some 250 yards behind in a bit of a valley. And it's surprising, even while we were there, the Germans seemed to have had an impression that we'd have to replenish stocks, and they seemed to know from the map where we could go, that while we were filling up with ammunition, we had a salvo of shells come over. Fortunately, they didn't hit us. When we got back to the ridge, it was all over. The guns were silent. So we moved up from there, continuing north, toward Monte Rotondo area. I was on a flank on my own, and the main squadron moved up, and I was ordered to go along the track to a ridge. I'd given the map reference. I could see the ridge, so that's about half a mile away. And the route there was fairly straightforward. We went along a little track to begin with, to see the ridge I had to get to. And as we approached the ridge, I was told that it had been checked by the wrecking troop and its objective was clear. Well, I'll check that when I get there. And as I moved along, we went down into a sort of little hollow. And at the bottom of the hollow, there was a gap of about 40, 50 yards without a hedge, just solid ground, which I don't have any idea for us to go through. To the right, there was a, what looked like a shallow ditch with a hedgerow and a little bit of scrub covered, and a further scrub on the left. Well, we went towards this gap that I was in the lead in the centre, my sergeant and corporal inside, as we did arrowhead formation. And when I looked, I could just see what looked like a mound of earth. Along checks of the binoculars, they were occupied with slip trenches. And I thought, well, this won't do. I reported that the area wasn't clear, there was enemy there, the infantry. And I said, I would deal with them as I went through. Well, we threw hand grenades in, they were firing with automatic weapons. And being in tanks, they couldn't have any effect on us. So we simply lobbed grenades in, slew the tanks round, and shoveled earth into the slip trenches, and my two tanks at the rear, as they came forward, they fired where we had been, so that we went through, and nobody surrendered. There was supposed to be some wounded there, and we just left them and went on. Another ridge, I see, just the one we were going to at the top, but just 40 yards or so below that ridge was another set of slip trenches. And we stopped, I suppose, about 30, 40 yards from these trenches. And I ordered the gunner to give them a burst of machine gun fire. I said, over the top, because I thought it would be handy to get some prisoners, if we could, to give the IQ people, intelligent people, some idea of the regiments there. We fired a burst of machine gun fire over the heads and waited a full moment or two. And just as the fire brigade at the trenches went out of a near trench came a bayonet. I see the point coming out. And the scruffiest piece of cloth you've ever seen came out on that bayonet. you know, in film you see a piece of white cloth come out. Well, this was black. And it came out and I said, cease fire, hold it, on fire. And this chap got up and he stumbled out of the trench and stumbled down the hill with his arms up and holding his rifle and the bayonet with this black cloth on it. And he got about 10 yards in front of the tank, 15 yards. I yelled, halt. And I said, put your rifle down. And he put it down, and it was just in front of the tank, so a roll over the rifle without action. And I looked at him, and he was uniforms open from top to bottom, trousers as well, the whole lot. I said, I'd like to see you now, son. He'd have you. And I said, fasten up your uniform. Now, whether he could understand English, I don't know, but he did just what he was told. He fastened the uniform up and he looked presentable. I said, come here. So he came up onto the tank. And my gunner said to me, he said, be careful, sir. It might be an act, this, you know, be careful. I said, I don't think he's fit to blow his nose, quite frankly. I felt sorry for him because he was absolutely a point of nerve. And I suppose so I shouldn't have felt sorry for him. He came up on the tank and I said, you sold it. Paper. He gave it to me. So I checked it. It was a Panzer Grenadier Regiment. I reported back that it was a Panzer Grenadier Regiment that we were in that position with. And they said, okay. I said to the chap, how many more are there? Well, they said, oh, five or six more in the trenches. And I could see them looking out, wondering how he was going on, you see. And at that moment, he was poking my shoulder and pointing into the tank. Me, he wanted to get in the tank with me. And I said, no. Next thing, he got a bundle of notes out of his pocket, handed me the notes, and his wristwatch he was going to give me. I said, I don't want them. I said, stay out there. And just at that moment, I said, right, the others were looking out, and I yelled to them, come here. And they came down, there were about six of them. Now these were smartly dressed, these were not the type to have in the tank or on the tank. So I said, down to the side of the tank, a lot of them. And they all went down to the left-hand side of the tank. And I thought to myself at the moment, although it was, you know, we were wondering what was happening, I thought, they all got down there, I wonder why. The next minute, we knew, because a hail of fire opened upon us. And it came from the hedgerow behind us that I'd seen as we came through, where the gap was for us to go through. It was spitting fire, the whole of that hedgerow, rifles, machine guns. And I knew then it had been a trap laid for infantry. I think they'd expected an infantry unit to go to that ridge, and they were surprised when the tanks turned up. So this chap, who was already on the tank, there were bullets whistling around. He pushed me and he got his foot inside. And the next minute he was looking at the end of my revolver. And I said, down, get with the others. Of course, he jumped down and he saw the revolver. And we traversed right onto the hedgerow because we just opened fire. We wrecked the whole lot and my other tanks were in love. And I said to them, went on to the radio post squadron headquarters, that there'd been a trap set and there was infantry in the trenches and there was infantry in the hedgerow. I said, we're clearing them out. And the squadron headquarters said, all right, I can see you. I had a fit. Because I thought, if they can see us, they're on a forward slope. And I looked back and in the distance I could see squadron headquarters on this forward slope. Now, that's a dangerous thing to do, to sit on a forward slope. And the next minute, I said, just look at that lot. I said, right. I said, move up the hill. So we moved up the hill to the crest so that I could look over. About 400 or 500 yards away, there was another crest and a valley in between. And on that crest, there was a big stone-built house, a nice house, I mean. And I looked at it and I thought, I'd be in position for artillery observation officer. Got my glasses on, the gunner said, I think I can see glints in that window, second right. Well, I got my glasses on, and sure enough, there was the donkey's ear, the artillery observation officer. And at that moment, I heard the guns firing. And I said to the gunner, I said, fire into that window, quickly. He let go with an HE, and he hit the window just just in the sign of it. It was certainly surprising, if nothing else, I said, amendment fired through the window. And I looked round and the shell were all bursting round squadron headquarters. I thought, oh heavens. And I sent the prisoners there, by the way, that I'd gotten because I didn't want them near me. And they just arrived there when the salvo shells landed. And it killed the second in command of the squadron. It wounded the squadron leader in the eye. And we didn't know that just at that moment. But as the second shot went into that window, it went right through into the room. And that would, I would imagine, dispose of the artillery observation unit. And I said, right, sort the rest of the building out, and particularly the area around it, because I'm sure there'll be more people in the hedgerows trying to get away. So the other two tanks, they did their stuff. They raked the area, the scrub and all the rest of it, with machine gun fire. And we put a few more shells in the other windows, just in case anybody else came in. And we just did that until there was no sound at all. And then down below where the hedgerow was, that was absolutely still and silent. We disposed of that lot. And a strange voice came over the radio and said that, Peter, one, you stay where you are. Sadly, squadron headquarters, second in command, killed.
Now their names were just at that time, do you remember?
Their names, yes. Yeah. It was Captain Johnson who was killed, and Major Swallow, who was the squadron leader, he was wounded.
Do you have any idea why they'd made such... It's quite an elementary mistake
it
in
is,
some
yes.
ways.
I couldn't understand why. I just couldn't understand it. Why they came to see... I think they came to see what was going on. Because having been told that the area was clear by the recce troop, they were of the opinion that it would be safer than to go, you see. But when I said that the area was actually occupied and that we were firing and disposing of the enemy, I suppose they wondered why they'd been misled. And they wanted to see the action, what was going on. They weren't aware that from the house on the far crest that they could be seen. I think that was the reason. And this observation officer obviously had been wide awake and he spotted them come onto the phone, so. And that was the reason. But why they went on this phone show in the first instance, I don't know, other than to see what had happened after being told it was clear. But there it was. And we were told to stay there, and A Squadron would come over eventually to take over from us.
Now, do you know the name of this ridge, or either of the ridges?
No,
not there. And what about, how did you get, I mean, did you manage to get further forward, or did anyone go through you, or did you have to retire from the position?
No, we stayed where we were. We were, should we say, the forward line, and it was getting late in the day.
No infantry came up then to join?
No infantry came up. A Squadron came over to take over from us, and when A Squadron came up, we were ordered to retire. And as we retired, again, the Germans laid a barrage across our retreating area, and we went through what was literally a wall of steel. The shells landed all around us. The dust and dirt came up, and we couldn't see where we were going. My corporal's tank just touched the tracks of each as we converged with each other, and then as we got through this wall of fire, of course, we separated and went our way. There was no damage caused. And from there, we just returned to harbour. It was quite late in the evening. But that was the end of that action. But it was a rather costly one from the squadron point of view, having lost the squadron headquarters team, really.
Now, what's the next thing you remember? Perhaps is the approach to Narni. That was round about the 13th of June, right?
Yes, the 13th. The approach to Narni, well... That again, we did quite a long advance march, and there again, we were moving over hilly terrain, and we were ordered along side roads to make sure the Germans hadn't left rear guards to ambush the troops as we went through. You see, you'd always got to be careful on these mountainous roads, that you were going along the major road, that there weren't parties along the side roads waiting to trap you, you see, and we went ordered off. There were lots of blows. The Germans removed culverts and things like that so that there were obstacles on the main road. You had to find diversions. there's often a diversion that was made obvious to you, and that was meant to remind you to be careful how you treated those. But we made fairly rapid progress, actually, and I suppose more by good luck and good manners than we got through. We didn't have any problems. And as we approached Nardi, and it was a winding road getting up to it, I saw people coming out. And this was the first time I'd ever seen people waiting to welcome us. And I was leading tank and leading troop. And I saw this look. Congregating around the big Roman arch, which is the southern entry, the Porta Romana, entry into Narni. I reported to squadron headquarters that people were coming out to see us. I said, there's a welcome awaiting us. He said, you're leading troop. He said, your job to get through that lot. Don't stop, whatever you do, get through. And I thought, I don't run over and help them as I go through. And they were all shouting and cheering at the entrance. And I shouted to one chap, I said, when did the Germans go? He said, oh, about an hour or so ago, something like that. And as I went through, I remember an old couple waving on the doorstep, arms around each other, tears running down their face, waving at each other. Quite an old white-haired couple. Just one glance, or a few parties hands there near them, and we went through. We went through the town, and I said to the gunners, watch for windows. I said, because you might get snipers still hanging around. We went through, but there was no trouble. And we went out through the northern gate, and we were ordered. I was ordered to the right, three troops were ordered to the left, I think it was, and two troops ordered to go along the road. But the road, in part, was mined, so they got to clear a few mines as they went. And we stayed there for a while on the flanks until the area had been checked and the flanks brought up to level. You've always got to be careful that you've got troops on the flanks, otherwise if you get isolated, sticking out in front, you can be caught in a trap. And we were stayed there for a while, and then we were ordered to move forward to Terni, and then Todi were the next objective. And we were then, when the mines had been cleared by two troops, there were no further mines, we all went forward towards Terni and Todi. And that was there was no main opposition. There were a few shells flying over, but not what I would call serious opposition. A few blows and things like that, which we got found fairly easily. One of the, well, the two incidents actually after Narni, which is perhaps interesting, we were heading north, and we were ordered to halt in a particular position. And when we were ordered to halt, I normally found a position where I could observe forward without being seen. But this was obviously strategy and tactics. This was a hill situation. I was just below the hill. On the left were trees and shrubs, almost up to the road. There was only about a 10-15 yard area clear. And the trees overhung the road. And I pulled in to the left. I was leading tankmates, Sergeant Porter behind me. And they were on the other side of the road. And as I looked, I could see way in the distance, about 2,000 yards away, enemy movement of trucks being removed. So we reported it to headquarters, and I said, I'll be taking them on. I fired. Well, I think we damaged a few, but we didn't knock them out. There were certainly damaged one or two, a little bit of fire started. And when they'd gone, there was no further point in firing at there. We stayed and just sat where we were. We were told to observe and stay where we were. After, I suppose, maybe it was an hour or so, I was watching round, checking the ground in front of me, but gone up to the crest, and the gunner could just see over. And about 400 yards, 500 yards away, across my front, a road ran from right to left. But our road joined this main road on a curve, and I watched carefully along here, and suddenly I saw a dispatch rider coming along, and I said to the gunner, Travis right, and he Travis left. Now that was unusual, because we were pretty smart on it. And then I looked again, and I realized why. He could see a motorcyclist coming from one angle, I was watching them coming from the other. said to him straight away, I said, point of intersection, fire HE. And he was spot on. The two motorcycles met and the shell landed at the same time. And the motorcycles disappeared. Then we just reported that incident and waited. Oh, I suppose maybe half an hour later, I saw a car coming in the road, a saloon car. And I said to the gunner, I said, get on that car. And I said, if it goes across the road in front of us, hit it. If it comes up, don't. I don't want it here. So I could feel it, see the gun following the car on the road, and it came up the road towards us. And the gunner, I'll never forget, can't believe this. He got his gun on him, the seal spot on. And I got in the binoculars, watched him coming up, and I could see there were two chaps. One was an older man, which I assumed to be the batman, of a smartly dressed young officer. They came up, chatting as though they were out for an afternoon's drive. And then suddenly, 20 yards from my tank, the car screeched to a halt, and they gazed open-mouthed at the Sherman tank with his gun straight on them. So I just said, signal to them to come here. And they got out. But as they got out, I noticed the young fellow leaned forward and put his hand under the dashboard of it. He's getting a revolver out, he's had it made. Anyway, he came out, he wasn't. I learned later that he pulled the leads out from the back of the dashboard. Crafty. They came out, and as they walked towards me, both got their hands up, they dropped the older man first, who was obviously a private or whatever you call them. The other officer, they got just up to the tank. And as they got to the tank, the officer pushed the older man. He stumbled forward and I watched him, and the officer dashed across the front of the tank, which he knew from training that we had little or no chance of spotting him because the gunners couldn't see at that range so close to the tank. Older chap recovered his balance and stayed by the side of the tank. And I signaled him to go to the other tank at the back. And at that moment, I said to the machine gunner, I said, fire to the target in front, but he couldn't see him. Travis left on the turret, and he was just disappearing into the trees, this character. It fired one round and jammed the machine gun in. And I said, fire HE. We got one on the spout, of course. He thumped on the foot pressure, and it didn't fire. Now, don't ask me why. I will never know why that gun didn't fire, but it didn't. We left the round in the breech. I picked up a Smiler, which I picked up on the battlefield, and I emptied it into the shrub where this chap had disappeared. By this time, the loader had cleared the machine gun stoppage. We fired the machine gun over the area in case he was still hiding in there. However, he disappeared. It, as I said, it was only about 15 yards to get into the trees and there was no sign when he was sick. So, at that stage, I said, now be careful. Keep your turret on the left and watch out. And I warned my corporal to keep his gun on the left in case the chap should reappear. I didn't think it likely that he would tackle us again. I said, better watch out. I said, right, I'm going to get the belongings from that car. So, my co-driver nipped out and gave me a hand. We brought back boxes of wine, suitcase, dispatch case, and anything else we thought would be of interest. We got them behind the tanks and we examined. I was in particularly interested in his briefcase with information regarding maps and stuff like that. They'd got bottles of wine and all sorts of goodies which they were thoroughly delighted to have. And he's got marked maps where regiments were, and he'd also got a newspaper with a photograph of him kissing a very delightful blonde, and it was entitled Officer. He'd also got the actual photograph. also got two very nice pencil sketches of, I reckon by the date, somewhere around Casino or Frosinone, that area, that he had done himself. I kept those because they were under the use of the people. They wanted maps with maps, red maps, positions on. And all the other information that he'd got in notebooks, I just sent the lot back to the intelligent people. But as I said, I've got the two drawings, which were very well done. He was a very capable artist, if it was him, and I suspect it was. and we stayed there. We were ordered to stay there. Well, I reported that we got the car. And later on, when we were ordered to retire, I thought, well, you know, I'd leave the car there. We'll take that, we'll use the squadron food. We went out to start it. Well, it wouldn't start because obviously it pulled the leads away. So I thought, well, we'd tow it. We're just getting the tow off the tank to have passing through the car, and suddenly the Germans shelled us. They must have spotted us. And the shells started to burst around, so I thought, blow this up. I'm going to get bumped off the car. So we put a shell through the car and retired. But it was, I think, if I remember rightly, we weren't actually retiring. We were moved off to a flank, to the right flank of one of our other squadrons who were in action. Obviously, when you're moving forward, if it's an open flank, you like to have somebody on that flank in case there's an attack on that. The Germans very often were quite crafty in that sense. We were ordered off to this right flank, and it was a road which I didn't like at all. It was a bit higher than the surrounding countryside, and you had a bit like ducks on a shooting gallery. And suddenly there's a shelling from the right, a shell whistled over. Well, couldn't see where they were coming from at all. My other two tanks fired in the general direction where the shells, where I thought the shells came from. They didn't stop, but at least it slowed the rate of fire down. And suddenly there was a thump on the back of my tank. And it was a high velocity, probably an 88 with a high explosion. And there was a mighty bomb. I felt as though my back was being cut in two. The blast from it came through the engine tower and into the turret. And the first thing I knew was the gunner's head coming up in front of me. He said, do we bail out? I said, no, get back. I said, it's only something on the back of the tank. And I looked round, it was the tarpaulin structure we got was ablaze. So I nipped out, undid it and kicked it off into the ditch at the side of the road. And I never thought, because the Germans had finished firing. But there was no more firing after that. That seemed to have finished it. And we stopped a little further ahead until infantry came up to take cover. And then we retired after that. And that was the end of that episode. It was quite a hectic day, actually.
You then had a period of rest. Anything special about the rest you recall there?
Well,
there's a piece in your book about what you do in the rest, a sort of general overhaul of tanks and guns. Would you like to comment on that at all?
Yes. Well, the rest period, you might have two squadrons in action. The other squadron might have a brief rest period. I think one of the essential, and to me, one of the important things was to have a wash and shave if you've got the time. You very often had a maybe 24 hours rest or something of that order, or even 12 hours. Wash and shave was because you felt much fresher after that. You also, of course, made a meal, brewed up tea and so on, because you never knew when you'd get the next one. And when that was done, you checked on guns and ammunition, petrol tanks and so on, make sure that everything was correct. And maybe mail for you if the echelon could get up. But you very often had a chance to write a letter yourself, which you kept on one side so that when the opportunity arose, they could be pushed back to echelon and then go off.
Well, letters and letter contact with, you know, your family and friends. I mean, were they important to you?
Yes, they were important, yes. Just to let them know that at that time we were safe.